This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1...
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, the podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
What are scissor grenades? I want one.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 73 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we love something so much, we build our formative years around it, we immerse ourselves in it, become part of the creative force behind it, then become the mad control freak perfectionist that rules over the entire domain with all the power and glory and toys. This week, we're looking at the two sides of Stephen Moffat coin. Steemo as the writer, who is credited by many as one of the best creators of recent Doctor Who content because of his clear love of the show and its history, versus Steemo as the executive producer and head director, or in modern parlance, the showrunner, seemingly maligned as often as being praised for his complex story arcs, character development, and promotional tactics with the media. Remember, Moffat lies. It's Kieran in the GPR studios with you this evening. Joining me as always is Jay. Good evening, Jay. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Fantastic as well. It is a snowy day here and not even close to that where you are. So somewhere in between is normality. And joining us in the studios this evening, a voice that many of our listeners will be familiar with, Amy from over at the Nerdy Dirty is guesting with us. Amy, how are you tonight?
I'm good. I got on the computer and I ended up on Skype and somehow I ended up here. I don't know how I did that, but I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
It's wibbly okay. Wobbly, timey wimey.
Yeah, that little blue showing up shortly that tells you where you need to be. So as mentioned, we decided that we were going to take a slightly different tact on the the endless raging debate over the quality of Stephen Moffat and his contributions to the show, and look at his balance of demands within the Doctor Who realm as a writer and as the showrunner, because flipping back and forth between those hats, he seems to take a lot of flack as well as praise on both sides. So.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Isn't this just what showrunners have to deal with? Because when Russell T. Davies was showrunner, he took a lot of shit for his couple seasons too. So it might just be a rite of passage that you're not going to please everybody, especially in Doctor Who, when there's 50 years worth of, you know, what's your favorite doctor, what's your favorite companion, what's your favorite episode. And then, you know, at least I guarantee half of the people watching are going to hate it. Mm. So is this just, you know, par for the course?
To a certain degree, I've got to think so. I think just maybe it's the fact that, you know, within the last couple of years with these seemingly increasing speed and variety of social interaction and group discussion, that people who tend to be vocal can now be even louder, or just the fact that the more that someone does and the more that they create, the more potential bent noses result.
Yeah, but I mean, still, it seems like Steemo catches a lot more crap than RTD did. Yeah, it's much more vocal, and I mean, granted, I don't know where Tumblr was in its developmental phase at the time that RTD was running it, but I mean, if you go on there right now, it's pure Moffat hate most of the time.
Yeah. Did you see? Take a look at the show notes. Take a look. There's an image. We'll share this when we post the episode as well. A nice little image there that he was in some interview with. It wasn't G4, but it was another one of those groups, and he said, "Oh, I know all about Tumblr. Tumblr is basically the place where everybody hates me. You know, yeah. it's a place where people that hate me gather." So. Even he recognized.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems like the hate against Moffat is, you know, far surpasses anything that RTD got. And I mean, that could be simply because he has earned more, or, you know, not necessarily earned, but...
Is he more visible? Well, I guess he'd be more visible.
Well, and that's the thing. It's the popularity.
First time in the history of who... Exactly. It's so popular over here. I remember growing up watching the old Who, and 9 times out of 10, I'd say Doctor Who, and they'd be like, what? Who? What are you watching?
Yeah.
And now, it's, you know, I see... you know, soccer moms with my other car is a TARDIS on the back of their minivan. It's very everywhere now. So
well, is that basically setting yourself up right there? You're saying that, you know, RTD is credited for helping the show's resurgence on that side of the pond. So he had a more limited viewing audience. So his number of fans and haters was a smaller subset. And now Moffat has taken that internationally, or I should say has surged it internationally. So now he's got, you know, a global set of lovers and haters. So is this just a larger scope of the same sort of treatment that a showrunner always seems to catch?
I think it's a little column A and a little column B, because I do have major problems with how he structures his seasons.
Well, there's an
interesting
article.
And we'll get into
it later. Yeah. Well, then let's start with some of these criticisms, because there's some people that are just as adamant. Maybe they're not as many of them, but there are people who are just as adamant as defending him. Let's start on how we were first introduced to him as a writer. We know from all of his interviews and things that he's been a Whovian, tried and true. And dyed in the wool since early childhood, and has been so immersed in it through his years that he's a walking, you know, compendium of Whovian knowledge, which is great to see. And you can tell that a lot of that comes through on some of his, you know, his interviews, his love of content, and his writing. So if he gets involved, or as he did, coming in with the BBC to do some principal short story writing, and then first got his opportunity to start writing first episodes, has that changed? You know, when you see his name credited as the writer for an episode, does that put any predisposition into your head about what you're about to see?
I get excited, because I mean, if I look back at the first four series of the new show, you know, every one of those series, my favorite episode from each one is a Moffat story. If you look at my top 10 for the first four series, you know, most of them are Moffat written stories. So anytime I see that he's writing, I'm like, okay, this is awesome, because I know that he can handle that. And most of the time, even since he became showrunner, most of the episodes that he's written have been fantastic episodes. You know, there's a couple that are, you know, a little less than desirable, but, you know, even on that, it's, you know, it's kind of like saying, well, that's the worst Pixar movie out there. Well, it's still better than 90% of the stuff that you're going to find.
Mm-hmm. You know? Okay. Amy, what's your take on it? When you see his name in the credits, what does that basically set you up for? Or does that sort of set you on edge because you're not certain what you're about to receive?
I think before season 6, I had a lot more faith in him. I love the Russell T. Davies era, Stephen Moffat, Empty Child, Doctor Dances, Girl in the Fireplace, The Silence in the Library, you know, Blink, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. Those all had these really tight, thrilling tension. The storytelling was really taught. The characters were polished, and even, you know, the one or two scene characters, the smaller roles, they had weight to them. And now I think he uses a lot of shorthand and a lot of big red button resets.
Mm.
And I just can't invest my full attention into a lot of his stuff anymore.
Okay. Well, I came across something kind of interesting. You know, we all watched the Doctor's Revisited set of interview segments that were released over the past year. Mm-hmm. And they always ended them with this little, you know, bookend talking to Steemo about his take on the Doctor's era in question, you know, for that given month, and a sort of lead into what we were about to see for the episode, or in a couple cases, episodes that were being used as the spotlight for that Doctor. And he seemed to be really positive and just loving everything about it. He couldn't say enough great things about damn near every Doctor who ever stepped out of the TARDIS and every evolution that the series went through, right? So, you know, you could tell he was a genuine fan there. Mm. But by the same token, I knew that struck me as a little unusual, because when he was getting involved in some of his first scripts for the BBC that were not the comedy series, like Coupling and those things that he had been writing for in the early mid-90s, he was interviewed about some Doctor Who-related things, and he kept saying, you know, oh, well, Peter Davison's my doctor, and this is evident when you see things like Time Crash and those. Mm-hmm. But he actually kind of slammed the original program, you know, anything pre-Davison, as, and I'm quoting here, slow, embarrassing, and limited by the relatively meager talent of the people who were working on it. And he came out and he got quoted as saying, if you look at the other stuff from the 60s, they weren't crap. It was just Doctor Who. The first episode of Doctor Who betrays the lie that it's just the 60s, because the first episode is really good, but the rest of it is shite. So he's like kind of all over the place with his opinions and statements about the show's conception and how it evolved into where he feels it is now. And I didn't know what to make of that. I mean, we know he lies right. about things we're about to see, but he doesn't often backtrack on his opinion of the of this content that he seems so near and dear to.
Well, I mean, you never... You go to any number of Whovians and ask them, you know, ask them to point out their favorite thing about each, about anything, you know, you're always going to have discrepancy. No matter how many people that you talk about, you're never going to find two of us that agree on every point of every episode of every little thing about, you know, the Hooniverse. A lot of us are closer together, but yeah, you know, the opinions range greatly. And that's, I mean, that's a great thing about this show is the fact that, you know, we can all love the show and it can be for completely different reasons. But yeah, so. It might be that, you know, some of the stuff that he appreciates and then some of the stuff that he craps on just don't line up with the majority of people who appreciate the show. And it does seem like it's scatterbrained, but to him, it might make perfect sense.
Okay. Well, I know he, maybe it's that line that he has to tread back and forth between his genuine and obvious affinity for the, for what we're going to classify as Classic Who and saying, all right, well, you know, when he, the first thing that he wrote for the show that was televised was the comic relief piece with, in 99 for the Curse of the Fatal Death, which was just that quick little, spoof piece.
Hilarious, though.
And it was really great, but you could tell all the things that he was poking fun at, you know, the screwdriver having, you know, three settings and so forth. It was all because he knew his stuff and loved it dearly. It takes a fan to be a good satirist.
Yeah.
So, but then the first thing that he puts into the show is The Empty Child and the Doc Dances. And he wins BAFTA awards for these things. And he wins a Hugo Award for writing Girl in the Fireplace and Blink. I mean, he just starts nailing them. This is a question that I want to put before the two of you, because this has to do with where it's heading now with him as the head writer. And Jay, you and I have talked about this just with this past series about the fact that, you know, if he's going to be a head writer, if that's part of the responsibilities of the showrunner, don't you need to have more of a say in some of the tweaking and editing of the episodes to temper them into where you see the series going? Not always arc related, but just, I don't know, something.
I think that, you know, it tends to go with the amount of control that he has and the length of the story he's trying to tell.
Yes,
because when he's got the two episodes, you know, those are great. I mean, one episode, two episodes, it's fantastic. We've seen with Sherlock, even, you know, when you've got 9 episodes worth of content, basically, you know, Yeah, he's great with that as long as he is, you know, in control of everything. And I mean, Sherlock's a different beast, so we won't try and bring that in too much. But, you know, over the short span, it's great. When he's trying to take a story from, you know, episode 1 and finish it up in episode 13, it gets a little bit long in the tooth. And you're like, okay, there should have been an explanation by now. We should have gotten something before now. But I understand he's trying to stretch it out. And then the fact that, you know, for 8 episodes in the middle there, he's, you know, just basically released control to other writers and said, okay, you know, just remember that this is the thing I've got going on and try and work it in if you can at some point. And it loses so much. If you can take the, you know, the episodes that Moffat writes and cram those together, I think that you would have a somewhat solid story. You know, it's all the stuff in between that kind of makes it all wonky.
Yeah, I think he's strongest at storytelling when it has a definitive endpoint and when he's limited in some way by an external force, like either time or budget issues or just not being the boss who gets what he wants.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times he ties himself in a knot because he has too much rope to play with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he comes out with these great beginnings to seasons, you know, and then he wanders for 8 episodes. And I think like what you said, Jay, it's like he's herding cats, all these other different writers he's trying to weave into a cohesive story, and I don't know if he knows how to delegate or maybe just go, this is my vision, please do this. I don't know if he's that kind of a leader when it comes to a writer room. So he usually has a strong endpoint and a strong beginning, but that middle is just a desert of bleh a lot of times for me.
Well, that brings me back to the question that I wanted to put in front of you too, is, you know, if we look at some of the episodes where we think his writing was at its strongest outside of emotional connection, you know, our ties to the 50th anniversary episode and things of that sort, because those were labors of love and those, you know, we knew that he was pouring 110% into them. Take of them what you will, or even Time of the Doctor, which still takes a lot of flack from people as being sloppy for various reasons. Not our words, okay? Just putting that out there. But if the ones that, some of the ones that we hold really near and dear, that we think are some of his strongest, you know, we mentioned Blink and Girl in the Fireplace, which is just a great, enjoyable episode, and Empty Child and all these things. Those are all under a different head writer giving those steering corrections along the way. We don't really know to what extent. And then you go and you flip that over, go all the way up to present day, and you start taking Sherlock, as you mentioned. Well, mm-hmm. Mark is involved in a lot of the dailies and little adjustments and steering corrections with that. So he's got Gaddis in his corner as part of the creative process. So that's the tempering he has there. He's just said in a recent interview, though, like within the last couple of weeks, Stephen has, that he can foresee Sherlock going on for ages because it doesn't require as much of his intense focus. Mm-hmm. It's things that he can walk away from. He says, when I'm in Doctor Who mode, though, I can't do anything else. He's mentally incapable of doing anything else when he gets immersed in that. What does that tell you?
You know what you were talking about just reminded me a little bit of like the George Lucas, you know, how when he was doing the prequels, how he was just surrounded by yes men, that he didn't have anybody critically saying, no, you can't do this. You know, this is why ABC, these are the reasons why you should not do this, because you know, you're going to write yourself into a corner kind of thing. And you're right. Maybe Mark Gatiss is that tempering, you know, force on him on Sherlock. And you also have to think, when he was just a writer under Russell T. Davies, he was in a way redefining parts of Who and refining parts of Who as a writer, not as a showrunner. That's a completely different dynamic. And in a lot of ways with Sherlock, he's in the same way he was doing Russell T. Davies, he's redefining part of Arthur Conan Doyle's works. So he has this template to work on. He has an endpoint. He has a story. He needs to know he hits notes A, B, C, and D and get to Z. And when he's on his own and he's left to his own devices and he doesn't have that tempering force like Mark Gatiss, he does tend to go off the rails.
Well, that brings up one of the I was trying to look at some of the pundits' statements that they were making about him. And obviously, you know, if you're going to start throwing darts at Steemo, then there's the other people that are going to try to grab them in air and fling them right back at the RTD era and comparing those two, because that's basically all that we really have to go on with a lot of the content that we're most familiar with in the last decade. So the writer's point, and this was a gentleman who did a blog entry that was picked up by What Culture, was coming out and saying that he finds it baffling how overrated, again, his words, how overrated the RTD era was, especially when considering the fact that people that seem to praise his work so much hate Moffat so much, and the reasons why they do so is they start pointing fingers and making accusations about Moffat's writing that, in this writer's opinion, is exactly what RTD was guilty of. And I wanted to kind of run through these because this might shed some interesting light on what your take is for whether this is something that Moffat is guilty or praised for. The first one being the correct, and by correct, I'm putting this in finger quotes because this is what you would consider the classic Doctor's portrayal, you know, as this genius, universe-wandering, pacifist scientist of sorts, that has a particular affinity for humans and earthlings in particular, and doesn't get overly emotionally attached as quickly as, you know, point finger at current showrunner and say, well, that guy, RTD, got way too, this Dr. Rose thing is just ridiculous. This is Twilight. But then you point at Moffat's writing and say, well, what's River Song? So what do we do with that one? Is that a success or is that a failure?
They're handled very, very differently, though. Yeah, that's the only thing that I can think that people might be able to point a finger and say that, you know, it's different, because while fundamentally they might be, you know, the same kind of, they're both the love interest, okay? Well, they're completely different characters and they're handled so differently. And I mean, you can't set one next to the other and be like, yeah, I can't remember which is which. They're so completely different that only the romance is the thing that they have in common, really.
And I think when you're talking about something like Doctor Who, favorites are relative to the person that's watching. Mm-hmm. And when you see any showrunner and you have more than a couple years under your belt, you're gonna make bad decisions and you're gonna make good decisions. And sometimes you don't execute the good decisions as well as you execute bad ones, and vice versa. So I can look back at Russell T. Davies' series, his seasons, and enjoy them for what they are, because it's a different time, it's a different viewpoint, and it's a different way of structuring Doctor Who. And then you go into Moffat, and he's 90 miles an hour weaving all these disparate storylines together into this, overarching thing. And it's just a different way of telling the Doctor story. And I don't think, at least for me, I'm not the type of viewer to get that tangled up in semantics. Well, this guy's better because of this, and this guy's not as good because of that. And it just kind of leeches some of the enjoyment out for me, just experiencing it the way, like a pure way of just enjoying the episode for what it is.
Okay. There's an interesting point brought up here that I think you two would be in a really good position to be able to tackle, and that's looking at Moffat as a writer versus Moffat as a showrunner when it comes to the balance between substance and style. And I think a lot of that is really what the core of a lot of these, bent noses and butthurt is really about, because some people just really want to have something that is stylistically thrilling, and other people really want a story that they can sink their teeth into, and they want that same quality week after week after week after week. So is there any difference here when he's wearing one hat or the other, or is it just a matter of the flavor of the week, and you work with what you have?
I think that it is case by case scenario. When we talk about more substance over style, I think the Angels Take Manhattan, I mean, there was a lot of depth that he tried to put into that one, but that one was clearly like, I want to make a spectacle. I want people to look and say, ooh, look at this cool thing that we've done, and it doesn't really hold up under the stuff that I've placed before, but it's awesome, look at it. But then you look at some of the other episodes that we've got, like The Empty Child or Girl in the Fireplace, and those rely less on spectacle. I mean, yes, you've got those moments, but they're a lot more solid story-wise. So I think it really depends on what is the story that he's trying to tell. Look at the Name of the Doctor. And there was a lot of spectacle to that, yes, but that was a lot of that was hype. But there was a lot of actual story there too. So it just depends on what mood he's in when he's writing the story.
Yeah. I really don't know how to answer this without kind of referring back to Russell T. Davies. When you watch his seasons, when you marathon through, the tone just, it's not as jarring as a change as when I watched even Moffat's stuff. Like, for example, when you watch A Good Man Goes to War, I'm in on it. I am sold. And you see Amy kind of broken because, she's been held captive and they've just stolen her baby, and she's making the Doctor promise to get her back. And then you go into Let's Kill Hitler, and it's like storytelling whiplash, because it's a completely different tonal shift. It's a completely change in the way that he's telling the story, and he jumps months ahead, and you see Amy kind of being all snappy dialogue, and nothing is really, she's being sarcastic, got herself, and you're like, when you watch them back to back, and they aired kind of a couple months between the first half of that season and the last half of that season, but when you're actually watching it marathoning through, you're just kind of like, whoa, what the f*** just happened? And I don't really get that feeling when I watch Davies stuff, and I think that's what I have the most problem with when I'm rewatching some of Stephen Moffat stuff. And another example I can think of is in The Girl Who Waited. I don't know if he's the one who wrote that, but at the end, Rory has this really intense kind of guilt for choosing that Amy and letting the older Amy go. And the next episode, it's like reset. There's really no carry through an emotional journey for the character. It's just back to, step one with the character. And they don't really grow over time the way Rose did, the way Donna did, the way Martha did. You don't really see that.
Well, that wasn't Moffat that wrote that one. That was actually Tom McRae. But
I know.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. I'm just like,
As he's a showrunner.
But as your showrunner, you've got a responsibility to look to that long view continuity, and especially when it comes to your character development. Both of these showrunners have been attacked for companion growth, and I don't mean age or weight or anything of that sort. Just the fact that they've made some sort of advances. They've been bettered for the experience in traveling with the Doctor. And so RTD was attacked because of the fact that Rose didn't really do anything but just get more bitchy as time went on. Donna was able to grow, and then they retconned her. So that was a complete wash. And Martha just got dismissed so and pulled the ripcord. So there was no growth there. So that was his attack. And then you come over to this side, and they say, oh, well, you know, Amy and Rory, they became such a close family. Well, the criticism was that because of the doctor, or was that because of the two of them discovering what they really mattered to one another? And Angels Take Manhattan is a case in point on that, because the doctor was helpless throughout, and it was their relationship that pulled through that entire episode. Their, you know, their swan song, literally, in one instance. So, you know, is that I have always felt, and I continue to feel to this day, that Moffat's strongest writing is his emotional writing, his interpersonal relationships, and his dialogue between individuals when they are being truly themselves. The quieter moments, the poignant moments. When he wants to play the harsh strings, he'll kill you. He'll absolutely kill you. Mm-hmm. And he's always been able to. You know, I go back, I was a big fan of the Coupling series when it aired, because I thought it was just a really well done sitcom or rom-com, call it whatever you will. But there were even moments in that series where the characters kind of broke everything down, and they spoke to one another on a very human level, and I thought, damn, you know, this isn't Friends, this isn't Frasier, you know, this is something a little different here. And we continue to see it now, you know, when there's the quiet moments between Smith and Clara, you know, and those sort of things. Granted, they're surrounded by some really confusing stuff. Well, maybe not confusing, but disjointed at times. And yeah, the hand waving and the big friendly button pushing, literally. but when he has those moments, those heart to hearts, he's brilliant. Yeah. That's his strength, I think. Does that mean then that he should have that tempering, have that Mark Gatiss in the room or something like that, to say, you know, oh, you're writing an action sequence? Here, let me take that. I got that covered. You just go over there, play with your dolls.
You need somebody like Gatiss to take the big red button away and lock it in a cabinet somewhere and go, okay, you can't use that for at least half a season, you know, and work out how to write your way out of this in a really well thought out way, and not use, you know, an exploding TARDIS or God knows what else, jumping into his time stream.
I think that it's less Mark Gatiss and more the structure of Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, the fact that you can't travel back in time to stop Moriarty before he stole the crown jewels. You know, the fact that you don't have any of these extravagant, you know, a lot of sci-fi and fantasy kind of suffers from this, because it's, you know, you have the magic wand to use when you need it. Whereas with Sherlock, everything has to be grounded in reality. You know, if all the stuff that they showed this season in Sherlock, when you know, all the different ways that he could have pulled it off and this, that, and the other. And a lot of those, you're looking at it and you go, really? Is that there? No, that's just not working, because it's supposed to be ridiculous, you know, but that's the kind of thing that they have to understand when they're writing that show, is this something that can be believable? With Doctor Who, you don't have to do that. The more unbelievable it is, the better it is in a lot of cases. So you can say, oh, the way that we're going to resolve this whole issue is that he was shrunk down in size a robot version of himself. You know, and that makes sense for Doctor Who. So you can have those wild and extravagant explanations that you'll give you an easy out. You can say, I'm going to put him in such a tight hole that, you know, there's no way to get away from this. And, oh, you know, the universe resets and we're all okay now.
Well, maybe that's, I don't know if that's necessarily, it's that black and white. Mm-hmm. I think to a certain degree, you've got to be careful about excessive use of techno babble and easy outs.
You know when he's most successful at it? When he shows you what he's doing and he doesn't tell you. Because there's a lot of times when he'll just info dump, or he'll use Strax and Madame Vastra to say, oh, the doctor's been really, really upset since Amy and Rory are gone and blah, 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 blah. And you don't really see it. They tell you, but you don't feel it. Mm-hmm. And I think he's more successful with the crazy sci-fi stuff when he's actually showing you. I think it was really, really well done in this last finale with Matt Smith, because he did take the time to show what was going on. It wasn't just, I don't know, montages and info dumps, and then there you go, there you have it. It's all taken care of and wrapped in a big bow for you, and I hope you like it.
Yeah.
I don't know. If I'm talking too much, just tell me.
No.
Well, I mean, we're hitting on a lot of the things that a lot of the more outspoken critics have been saying. I mean, I came across a Hypable review, and I dumped it in here for you guys to take a look at as well, that literally just took a huge chunk of what we were just saying. His point was, because he was talking about, and this was written towards the close of, after the midpoint of Series 7, and he's saying, you know, when events can be explained away by those giant reset buttons, like we did in Season 5, mm-hmm. or a robot filled with tiny people, as we did in Season 6, or the quick jump into someone else's time stream, as we had in Season 7, it allows the writers to go off the rails without planning any real way to rein things back in. Amy, directly to your point, mm-hmm. you know, you get into something where, you know, you've created all of this intense drama. You've intentionally tried to make it overly dramatic, and then you pull a ripcord. And now is suddenly supposed to be status quo again.
Yeah.
And that's difficult for a viewer to make that kind of gear shift mm-hmm. and still feel that there's a flow to a season. I don't know. I mean, I was okay with Season 6. I was okay with the Impossible Astronaut arc because it did, you know, with Madame Kavarian popping in every once in a while, a little disjointed, but... You know, it was something where you could tell that there was some other stuff going on here. You know, it wasn't exactly fringe level of intricacy by a long shot, but you could tell.
Well, I mean, talking with a listener, Mark, a little while ago, and we were discussing this, and specifically about Series 7B. And, you know, one of the things he said is, you know, that's one thing we miss over here in the UK is that we don't have that writer's room kind of format. You know, they don't get all the writers together and say, this is the story that we're going with and work it out as a group. It's pretty much just, okay, you take this episode, go and work in your office. You take this episode, go and work in this office. And, you know, little things like that. And they don't have the... You know, the working together, they're not working as a team. They're working as individuals that Moffat then has to put together to make his story work.
Mm-hmm. And I think Season 5 worked for me because it was grounded with young Amy and, you know, the girl who waited that whole arc with Amy as an adult and how they kind of became a family towards the end. Season 6, I could see that they were trying to kind of center it more on River. It was less successful for me, but I really did enjoy that season overall. Season 7A was great. I loved it. I think he hit every emotional beat. I think he did what he planned to do in finishing off the Amy and Rory arc. Season 7B, I have to tell you, it was not as emotionally satisfying. I wasn't invested in Clara. I didn't like the rehash of this is a special girl because it's kind of gotten repetitive where he has this special female companion that's a mystery and she's really special for some reason that we'll discover later on in the season. But for now, we'll keep it under wraps. Isn't she cute? That whole part of Season 7B, by the time it was over, it was almost a relief to finally be over it. And the whole reason Clara was special, I was just like, okay, that's fine. I'm really not awed by her. And I think that was a misstep.
Well, is that, I mean, that kind of leads to the question, though, is are the companions kind of crucial in how far you can take the story? Because in RTD's day, you had Rose, and she came in knowing absolutely nothing. And as time went on, things got a little bit more extreme. Then, you know, we had the regeneration. And so she was with a new doctor, and things kind of almost reset to the point where it's like, okay, now we're starting with somebody fresh. Let's go in this. And then Rose was gone. Then we had Martha, and she stuck around for just a little while. So everything had to go back to square one with her. And you constantly had that going back to zero and then getting a little bit more extreme. And then when we got to the 11th Doctor, like you said, with Series 5, everything seemed kind of grounded. And, you know, it was starting at zero and getting a little bit more extreme. Well, then we got to Series 6, and you can't go back to zero because they've already had those experiences. So it gets even more extreme. Then in Series 7, it's even more extreme. And by the time that we finally got to Clara, it might just be that Moffat was in that groove of things have to be bigger and more extreme.
Yeah,
I've often wondered, was it really necessary? Would it have really been such a tremendous impact if Clara was no mystery and they were just, you know, two characters that hit it off really well together because she was sassy and quick-witted and she could roll with anything and don't worry about her being impossible or anything of that sort and just have a good, valuable companion and go off and find your freaking adventures.
Yeah, I would have absolutely loved had we gotten Victorian era Clara as the companion, you know, not have it be something extreme. Just like, hey, yeah, here, I went here to mope because I lost Amy and Rory, and here's this amazing woman that just kind of pulled me back into things, and you know what? Let's just go with her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The thing with Claire is when they had the big talk at Journey of the Center of the TARDIS, when he absolutely went out and said, what are you? And they had that talk, and he came to an understanding that she was just a regular girl. And then they reset it, and they're not supposed to remember. And I was screaming at the TV going, why did you just do that? Why did you just show us that scene and then erase that scene at the end of the episode? I don't understand you. That's why it's so frustrating to watch some Stephen Moffat stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why did you write that perfect scene and then just completely throw it away?
Yeah.
That ties into a lot of criticism that he receives, both from his writing and his show running about, you know, is he leading to an overcomplexity of the show? Is he trying to make it either too cerebral, or is he trying too hard to tap into, you know, the long game at every turn and say, hey, remember that long mystery you guys had about wanting to know what actually caused the TARDIS to explode? Hey, let me throw this one in here. By the way, I'm mentioning this whole, you know, security church thing that I just introduced to you in this episode that's only going to be poignant for about the next 42 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, is he challenging the audience as a writer, as a showrunner, for allowing other writers to introduce some of these curveballs or write in a similar style that are taking unnecessary risks or introducing unnecessary elements to the show that just muddle it? Or is this what Doctor Who is all about? Spending half the time going, what the hell's going on? Because we, as much as we complain about it at times, we enjoy being confused.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy being confused up to the point where I get the explanation. I don't want the explanation to confuse me.
Yeah. I think if you would agree with me, I think some of the most successful episodes of his showrunning time have been the one of episodes where it's a very traditional story arc, a beginning, a middle, and an end, like Vincent and the Doctor or the Doctor's Wife. And then I know he didn't write at least the Doctor's Wife, either one of them. But when you look back at your favorite episodes of his seasons as showrunner, they are always those slower, very character-driven, emotional stories. And all the flash and the glitter and the whiz-bang, that's fun the first time around you watch it, when you're going, whoa, that was really cool. But Doctor Who, for me, has always been great rewatchability value in it. And those whiz-bang, big flashy things don't hit the same beat the second or third or fourth time around. And you're sitting there looking at the very thin plot, the very thin skeletal plot that's holding it all together. And that's when you start really kind of wishing for more meat on those bones.
Well, you watch Let's Kill Hitler a couple times, or if you watch, Pandorica. The first time you saw it, I mean, it was this spectacle. Holy crap, all of stuff. You know, and the Sermon on the Mount. And again, you know, those are some of the things. You can grab the individual pieces, and you know when you're seeing them, too. You're like, oh, this is Moffat in his sweet spot. But it doesn't last a whole episode. Mm-mm. And you might, on first viewing, you come away with that kind of warm feeling because you had one or two of those scenes that just really kind of revitalize you. But if you go back and watch it again, all those other scenes start to show their stitches. And it I'm not going to say it cheapens it, but we overanalyze. This is what we do. I mean, we're passionate about the show and about all the intricacies about it. And it's just like, you know, we've talked, Jay, about this, you know, when we go back and first episode is for squee factor, second episode is for story, and third episode is to tear it to shreds. A third viewing is to tear it to shreds. And we always do it. But it seems to be easier to do with the episodes that he's written that didn't come at the pivotal points, you know, series beginners and series enders, you know, because he always wants to bookend his seasons and he crushes them. But if he steps into one in the middle, it's going to be weird. Or if he has to go in because, you know, as you were just talking about, not having a writer's room and they're all working in bubbles and they hand in all their scripts and he says, oh, well, mates, I had this idea that I wanted to make sure that this theme kept running through about the impossible girl. Well, I didn't understand what you were doing with it. So I wrote this other episode. It was a really great episode. He's like, no, don't worry about it. I'll stick this 10-minute little coda on the end of it.
And completely ruin everything.
Exactly. That has nothing to do with what you just saw for the other 32 minutes. But it stirs things up and throws up on you and then rolls credits.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But thanks for the period piece. You did a great job.
Yeah. Do you guys prefer Moffat writing for Tennant or for Smith? Because when I look back on the stuff he's written, I'm looking at the list. The ones that stand out to me are the ones that he wrote when Tennant was the Doctor. Those are my favorite ones.
Okay, if you're asking Tennant episodes or writing for that particular Doctor.
I'm wondering if maybe the performance informs how he writes, you know, the performer itself. Because when you hear Tennant turn a phrase of dialogue that Moffat's written, it's fantastic. But I don't really feel that with Smith. He has the big, bigger than life performances, and he does more with his eyes and maybe with his hands than I guess Tennant was more gravitas and Shakespearean. And I'm just wondering if maybe the fact that he became showrunner at the same time Tennant decided to leave, I don't know, maybe I'm just fangirling wishing that there was a season with Tennant. And maybe I would really have enjoyed that.
Well, I mean, if you look at the episodes that he wrote when Tennant was actually on the show, you know, mm-hmm. you've got the girl in the fireplace, which I love that episode. You know, everybody knows that's one of my favorites, but it's not necessarily because of the way that the Doctor himself was written. It was the story. Blink, the Doctor was hardly in it. You know, the Silence in the Library, again, it was more the story than actually the Doctor. And, you know, a lot of that was River too. But when you get to, you know, when you get to the 11th Doctor, you know, I'm thinking back on some of these, you know, like the Pandorica's, you know, his speech during the Pandorica, the moment in The Name of the Doctor when Clara tells him that they're going to Trenzalore, you know, the moments like that, when it's like, I remember the Doctor, you know, the way that the Doctor spoke or things that happened to the Doctor that really impacted me. And those are the ones that stick out. Whereas with, you know, Tennant's episodes, it's the story that really drew me.
Okay. I think, in my opinion, and I'm going to agree with Jay on a number of points here, Moffat writing for the Tennant tenure mm-hmm. was not necessarily, in my estimation, him writing for Tennant specifically. We were getting, you know, again, you know, the phenomenal stories, the, you know, Forest of the Dead and Silence in the Library and those things that were just stories that carried well, and that Tennant just took and put his all into. I have a very strong suspicion, because there was a huge camaraderie and affection between Moffat and Smith, that from a very early point, when Moffat was the one writing, you know, we've talked about the fact that Smith evolved. He definitely did strengthen as the Doctor over the course of his seasons, mm-hmm. because they were giving him meatier material to work with. You know, he wasn't mm-hmm. always clowning, you know, beyond the fifth season. He wasn't always just sliding around and flapping his hands and you know, waving his screwdriver and just being basically a very young, skinny Patrick Troughton for very long. But I think he found Moffat found a rhythm with him or something in him that he wanted to draw out. So he would write material that would allow him to, you know, begin to flex a bit and strengthen a bit. So again, you know, just as we said before, they're just moments, and often they weren't enough moments in there to really carry the entire episode at that same level. But when he had them, and Jay, you pointed out, they're the emotional moments, because again, I think that's what Moffat's strength really is writing those emotional dialogue-driven moments, mm-hmm. because he is a brilliant story writer. Mm-hmm. That Smith was able to really do so well with them, you know, the come on, come at me, bro, kind of moments of big strength, or those crushing moments where you see the weight of his years and his sins and his guilt and so forth weighing on him. And that was, I think that was Moffat writing directly to Smith. So maybe to answer your question, Amy, I think he was maybe not in the former. He wasn't necessarily writing for Tennant, but by the time he was writing for Smith, I think he was writing for Smith.
Yeah. You know, I have to add, he not only does emotional beats well, he does creepy well.
Oh, yeah.
He might be the best creepy idiot savant of, I mean, maybe not. You know what I mean? But he takes these little things that maybe when you were a kid, you're like, don't look under the mattress, or don't look in the closet, don't turn the lights off, don't blink. And then he turns it into this horrifying yet simple concept that just keeps you up all night after you watch an episode. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody is as successful as he is at doing that.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's necessarily because of his longstanding love of the show, and that he's just sort of cataloged what makes a creepy crawly, or if that's really just what rattles through his head and he's just a really twisted little bastard. But
he's,
I mean,
a twisted little bastard.
Yeah, look at the what he's created. He loves to go back and revisit classic villains, sure. But look at the ones that he's created and introduced to the show, as far as
things that go bump in the night.
Yeah,
you know, weeping angels, the silence. You know, that's creepier than anything. The Vashti Narada things that you. I think the Vashti Narada is creepy, but I think the silence is even creepier because as soon as you don't look at them, you forget they're there.
Yeah.
And that's one of the creepiest concepts ever for me. You know, something so manipulative that has their hooks in everything, and yet you don't know they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Which just made it all the more confusing in Time of the Doctor when he was suddenly paired up with them and they're all running around together.
They were the priests. They were the good silent.
Hand wavy, wavy, yeah. wavy.
Yeah.
But it happened so fast. Again, what was it? What was the quote, Jay? The doctor said it himself, and it basically summed up Moffat to a T. Talk real fast, hope something good happens, and take all the credit?
Yeah.
That's just it. Because, oh, it's going to be a cracker. You're going to love it. It's a cracker. I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Then here's the last thing that I wanted to kind of point out here, because he did an interview not too long ago that said that, you know, he could see the time when he's no longer running Doctor Who, and the interwebs went a little hiccupy for a while, wondering if that was him starting to bow out. I know he said back in like March of last year that statistically he's towards the latter half of his tenure running the show, as he estimates it, which would mean that he'd be done by 2016 if you did the math on it.
I think it's a bit like a presidential term. You know, after 4 years, you're like, I'm done. I've become an old man. The stress has gotten to me, you know.
Yeah.
Can imagine he just wants a vacation now.
Well, do you want to hypothesize then, not necessarily names, but the type of individual who would be best served in taking the reins of the show? And are we just assuming that he would at least stay on as a principal writer?
I think that the show would lose a tremendous asset if he didn't stay on to write, you know, at the very least. You know, just one episode per series. You know, he's proven that he is a fantastic writer, and nobody's ever taken that away from him, you know, in the short runs that he's done.
2-episode arc every season. Absolutely. I know it will never happen, ever, because he just would say no, but I would love Neil Gaiman. He would never do it. And not a showrunner.
Yeah. Now, he addressed it in an interview like within about the past year or so and said, you know, there's absolutely no way that I could take it on logistically. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't allow. But I don't know if he's been really pressed for more information. I think he would be brilliant because he is probably as close to the same sort of long term. You know, I sleep with my, you know, plush Dalek under my pillow that I've had since 1975. You know, same kind of fanboy.
Well, for a while, especially through season 7, it felt like they were grooming Mark Gatiss to be the showrunner. So I don't know if maybe they're going to do that. But I'm kind of curious to see what your wish list would be, especially with Peter Capaldi becoming the new Doctor 12. Is that what they're calling him now? Even with the
he's War the 12th Doctor. The BBC 12? Has actually like come out and given a breakdown. They said, okay, this is the, you know, nth regeneration. We call him the, you know, 8th Doctor or whatever. This is how, you know, and they broke it down. But, you know, Capaldi is the first regeneration in the second set of regenerations, but he is the 12th Doctor.
So, you know, especially when you see Peter Capaldi's work and what he's done, he's a darker, grittier actor than Smith. He's older. He brings with it a lot of he looks like he's lived a lot of lives with that face. Who would you like to see as showrunner, as head writer for a Peter Capaldi season?
I don't know who, like, a specific name, but the kind of showrunner that I keep coming back to wanting is somebody like Joss Whedon, who, you know, has a brilliant feel for this is the story I'm going to write. And, you know, he starts from the end and works his way back so that everything leads directly into that ending. Instead of, I have this great idea for a story, let's throw these aspects in and I can tie them together with this Deus Ex Machina. Yeah, it's you need someone who understands the end game like Joss Whedon does.
Just as long as it's not J.J. Abrams, right?
Did they even allow him in London?
If they put him in another geeky sci-fi series head role, I'm going to stick Boone in my heart and twist.
Yeah.
I've put a lot of thought into whether Mark Gatiss could do justice to the overall spectrum of the show. You know, I mean, we look at what he's credited for in terms of televised material, and we've got some great episodes there. We also have some stinkers, you know. He was responsible for the Idiot's Lantern, you know. Yeah. The Lazarus Experiment he was just starred in, but still.
The Crimson War.
But then again, you have something like Cold War, which I personally enjoyed, which, again, sort of had that kind of a Moffat feel as far as tipping back to previous Whovian elements, you know, the Ice Warriors in this particular case, in being able to give that tip of the hat to where the show's been and working with it in where the show is headed. I don't know of anyone else right now that has been as intrinsically involved with the show on numerous levels like Mark has that could, at least at the moment, you know, maybe the next year and a half is going to, you know, farm somebody, but who could really do so and say, you know what, I may only be in this chair for a year, but I got this. I don't know.
Well, we did get some. What were you saying?
What about somebody like Vince Gilligan? You know, he's just finished Breaking Bad. I think he might be looking for a job.
Wow.
I don't know. I still hold on to the fact, like, you know, the Doctor needs to be a British actor. That, you know, you can't have an American actor. I think showrunner fits that too. It's like they have to be British just for it to have that the correct feel.
So. Well, you've got to have somebody. I mean, figure the showrunner as a moniker is really that combination of executive producer and head writer. I mean, that's really, as far as a lot of the BBC roles, or I should say not just BBC, but a lot of anything on across the EU, as far as those kinds of shows, whether it be out of Wales or whatever, requires that writer's element. So there are a number of individuals who are passionate about the program and could tackle it from a business perspective. We all know, we've heard the longstanding jokes, you know, the Hollywood gags about, you know, about executive producers coming in and saying, you know, with their cigar clenched in their teeth going, no, I don't like it, more whiz bang, you know, and they have nothing to add other than just, I want boffo. Mm-hmm. So that's got to be the trickiest element, is finding somebody who's got writer's chops and can step back and look at the franchise and say, we have to make some hard decisions about where we're going to go. As much as we'd like to write about XYZ, it would kill us inside of a half a season to go in this direction, because we're going to alienate people, or we're never going to pick up new viewers by pursuing this arc or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got a lot of feedback from listeners on this topic. Thanks to everyone who hit us up on Twitter. You know, looking over some of these responses, though, I mean, we've got a wide variety of people. Like, nobody, there's not a strong consensus of, yes, everybody is, you know, either comfortable or hates them or whatever. There's a wide variety here. I mean, okay, these are Twitter names, so I apologize in advance for butchering them. we've got Galv, who says, you know, he writes so wonderfully, but he needs supervision. I don't think he understands what a story arc is. That's a little bit harsh, but I can see what you're getting at here. You know, he definitely does need someone to, you know, to be that reality check for him.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes as fans, you become overly frustrated with the way things are, storylines are going, and the way he structures seasons, that you tend to look at only the bad and not a lot of the good that came along with it. So that may be where a lot of the anger is coming from, because I felt that way too. Mm-hmm. Well, I think I just revisited it a couple of minutes ago when we were talking, so I know exactly what he's talking about.
And then we got something from Closet Brit. Said, I think he's great at both. The problem comes when he doesn't have time to supervise the other writers. Exhibit A, you know, Series 7. So again, it's, you know, kind of the same coin, but the other side. It's, you know, he needs to be in control as much as be controlled a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Well, head writer in the room is not the sole writer. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, you know, head writer is also principal editor. So if you've got you know, we had a conversation started among some of these tweets here, and Raz jumped in and said, you know, they were talking about arcs and said, you know, the Impossible Astronaut as an arc worked, but without restrictions, without something to kind of rein that all in, there's the concern that Moffat is becoming Tim Burton.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, you know, I have a vision, and just get out. If you don't agree, get the hell out of the room. I'm going to do this. I'm going to call up Johnny Depp. I'm going to call up Helena, because I don't work with anybody else these days to do this thing. But his final point was really, really spot on. He said, even Neil Gaiman has editors.
Yeah.
As much as we hate to admit it, you know, those books and those stories and those graphic novels that we love, those have all gone through rewrites. So,
yeah, that's true. And we got something from at Moffat, the doctor, who said, you know, guess what? They're the same person, and they're continuing to do a wonderful job for the show. You know, ask the BBC. And I mean, I think that's what it comes down to is, you know, as much as we might give him crap for little things, he is doing a fantastic job with the show. You know, you don't look at it and think, wow, you know, this is the J&T era all over again, where, you know, it's going down the hole. We're just waiting for it to all fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the numbers don't lie.
Yeah, the show is stronger than it's been, you know, ever, really.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it may not be, you know, the personal tastes of a certain vocal percentage of the fan base, you know, mm-hmm. as far as what they want to see from the show right now. But again, part of the showrunner's responsibility is looking at the direction of the franchise. And from that standpoint, he's doing a bang up job, because the show is growing and the viewership is growing and the global recognizability is growing. You know, if you can see a kid, in Cairo wearing a TARDIS sweatshirt or something of that sort, you know, it's something's working.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. So,
yeah.
But like I said, you know, the opinions are everywhere. It's not a general consensus of yes, it's, you know, it's A, B, or C. I think that, you know, it is a good indication that it's just the people that are vocal that are making such a big stink about this. Yeah, because mm-hmm. we might complain about Moffat every now and again. I like him. Yeah, I love him. I think that he's a fantastic writer, and I think he's doing a fantastic job with the show, because he's not looking at it as, you know, a fanboy playground. He's looking at it as, how do we get the next generation in? How do we get new viewers to come into this so that it's just not, you know, a stagnant old, you know, boys club where everyone sits around and discusses, you know, something that happened in, you know, in season 3 back with the first Doctor, you know? Mm.
And how do you get them interested to go back into the past and watch older classic episodes, you know?
Well, I think he's
I think he is doing a good job with that. He's very successful at doing that.
Yeah.
I think he handled the 50th anniversary year beautifully in terms of putting the material together and overseeing the kinds of specials and little introductory elements and refresher courses and things that have cultivated probably a new set of fans that are just getting introduced because they want to know what all the screaming yelling is about, but also taking new Whovians and making them actually for the first time possibly want to go back and find out what all of these references are they're getting, and all of the, you know, the 50th anniversary was chock-a-block full of them, or the, like we mentioned, the Doctor's Revisited series that were coming out and were released both in the US and the UK, so they get a chance to see, you know, who's that weird dude with the scarf that was 20 feet long and the, what was that all about, you know? And now they have an opportunity and a comfortable avenue to go back and rediscover all that material. So again, the show grows and continues, so can't take away a thing from them that.
No. Yeah, I think that's the thing that we need to remember is, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when someone gets elected president that you don't like, is, you know, it, you might have to deal with a lot of stuff that you're not happy with, but that's their job. That's, you know, this is what they're doing. You're not going to go and take their job away from them because you got 1,000 signatures on the internet. You know, it's, look for the good in it. You know, make the most of it. If you can't stand the guy, look at the fact that, you know, he has said that he's not going to be around forever. You know, but I think that there is just so much good to be taken out of his run as showrunner that, you know, there doesn't need to be, you know, the petitions to get him banned or whatever. You know, and again, that's a very small vocal portion of the fan base.
So. I don't think you can take Doctor Who and Stephen Moffat and separate them, because they're so interwoven, even through the Russell T. Davies series, that they've, in a larger way, he has informed an entire generation about Doctor Who. And Doctor Who is about change. Over 50 years, it's about change. Mm-hmm. And this generation that's grown up with Matt Smith, they're in for quite a treat when when, you know, the showrunner changes and the doctor changes and the companions change. And yet the essence of the show, what really captured us when we were kids and what still gets us excited to watch every time it's on TV, is that wonder, is the curiosity, is the humanity and the hope.
Yeah,
and that is always there, no matter who's showrunner.
I think at this point we're going to end up repeating ourselves a lot in terms of, I think the takeaway I'm getting from this is that, you know, like any writer, there are strengths and weaknesses. And you know, you come to really enjoy writers when they're in their niche and doing what they do best. And if those are redeeming enough, then you can overlook some of the writing elements that are not as strong. This is a little bit of a different scenario because of the fact that we microanalyze those writers and we, you know, we crucify them at a moment's notice. But, and then on the showrunner side of things, you know, you can either look at it as, you know, what are you doing with my beloved program? Or you can look at it as, what are you doing? You know, look at what you've done with this show that I love and how you've given it more life and more growth and more opportunity. So you tip the scales however you want on that, whichever one you think is more important to you. Does the show have to be all about what you want, or does the show have to be something that we need to ensure has another 50 years to go? So I've never been a hater for the man wearing either hat. You know, I'll rib him and call him out on things that I think are a bit clunky, but the man is a fan and he writes and he runs something that he loves. So I can't blame him a thing for that.
True. Very true.
Agreed.
Well, we've got some news that's come out this week. Unfortunately, the big news, the sad news, is that the director, Christopher Barry, has passed away at the age of 88.
He was of particular value to the program just because of the fact that the material that he put together, he was actually one of a very small set of people who were able to direct Hartnell, Troughton, Pertwee, and Baker.
Dude.
So you talk about somebody who has seen the show grow. I mean, he took it from the initial seasons when they didn't even know what the show was really going to be about, other than being the weekly serial with these time-driven adventures, into something that had some of the most complex plots of any program that had been aired to date by the time they got to Pertwee and Baker's years. And they were tackling all kinds of, you know, heady material that you know, you wouldn't have even guessed the audience was going to be capable of comprehending, let alone want to watch. So, huge credit there.
Yeah, so he will definitely be missed. We've also got a release from Forbidden Planet, the 12th Doctor's regeneration outfit figure.
Forbidden Planet cranked out a whole bunch of new figurines this time around. So you've got your Capaldi in Smith's purple suit. And that's now I think they're even doing box sets where you can get the Regeneration 12th along with Smith in his figure in the same outfit, and John Hurt's War Doctor as a little three pack whatnot.
Oh, wow.
But again,
but you're
going to end up paying, if you're here on the stateside, you're going to pay more
just as much
than
for
double.
Shipping as you do.
Yeah, it's rough.
I'll tell you what I want. I want the little Lego minifig of the Capaldi Doctor and of the War Doctor, because then I would complete my collection. I have them all along my TV, and I put them in different, like, karate chopping, you know, battle-looking things.
I've got them all lined up here right on my desk staring at me while I podcast. So, yeah, I need those two.
I had them all lined up. They were playing grab ass one time. And then I'm like, okay, I can't disrespect the doctors. And I took them all down.
They were probing. It's a probe.
It's just a sonic screwdriver. Shh.
Oh,
you're never going to have me on again. I'm sorry.
She's playing grab ass with the doctors.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. So then the last bit of news that we have here is in an interview. Actually, it was in a panel at New Orleans Comic Con. I'm sorry. The Matt Smith has revealed that he doesn't want the 12th Doctor to have interactions with River. He was laughing about it the whole time. So it's not like him getting really butthurt, but he was saying that, you know, he feels like River was the 11th's wife. You know, that was the story there, and that Alex was his companion or his. You know. So he was like, you know, he said, I asked Steven, please just don't. Seriously, don't. You know, she was mine.
he's been saying a lot lately. You know, you get him after, you know, after things have cooled down. He's between film shoots right now, and he's going to a lot of these cons and things, and he's been coming up with all sorts of stuff. He originally, you know, like a year or two back, he said, "Oh, I'd love to be on Breaking Bad," and then just like a week ago, he said, "You know, I absolutely love The Walking Dead. I'd love to be on that show. That'd be really cool."
So you know, you're just gonna zombie.
You're just gonna stir people up by saying this stuff, and I think that's all he's doing at this point. Is just
I would love to see him on Community on an episode of Inspector Space Jam.
That would be great.
Yeah. So yeah, next time you see that that Matt's going to be on the docket for any con coming around your area, prepare to get an earful of some really weird stuff.
Yes. But yeah, unfortunately, that's all that we've got this week. It's we're hitting the dry spell where everything is going to come in little dribbles, and then we're going to get like 3 news items in 1 week and get all excited.
And we're going to get webisodes. I'm telling you, we're going to get webisodes. I don't know what they're going to look like. I don't know what they're going to tell us, but I genuinely think we're going to get webisodes. Yeah, I'm going to try and pick up. I actually socked a little money aside because I want to pick up some of the most recent Big Finish audio productions that have been out there, some of the ones mm-hmm. with McGann. So if I get a chance to grab a hold of those and listen, we've had a couple of listeners, Soleil and a couple of others, that have been curious about whether they want to trade their heavy podcast listening rotations and try to fit in a few audiobooks. I'm a big fan of some of the Eighth Doctor Adventure ones that they'd done years back, and now that they've got them back in the studio and they're throwing some great material at them, I want to give these things a spin.
I love the Eighth Doctor. I wish that they would do a couple webisodes with him a little more, because I loved that webisode they did with him.
Yeah. That was amazing. Such a door for it. They could easily, you know, be able to do some of that, either, you know, just prior to what we saw on Night of the Doctor, or give John Hurt an opportunity for fun.
Oh yeah, flesh out the Time War. I mean, that'd be brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
He was interviewed about a week and a half ago. Hurt was, and someone asked him something about whether or not he'd be interested in doing, you know, little appearances. And the way the writer transcribed it, he was surprised that they would even ask him to do that. He's like, why would anyone want to see that? What? Are you kidding me?
Because you're fantastic and we want to see more.
I don't think he understands what he stumbled into here. It's like, you know,
it's like Alec Guinness in Star Wars. What was this? I don't understand why you guys all like me so much. It was kind of dumb.
How long do I have to keep talking to this soda can? I don't know.
Yeah. This is the time of the hour where Kier likes to ramble.
Oh, not at all. This is all relevant stuff.
Okay, news.
But next week, we are going to take a bit of a segue from what we were going to, or what we had done with our roles of the Doctor a couple weeks back. And we were talking about the fact that at times he is the mentor, the educator, the friend, the lover, the what have you. And we decided to take apart a lot of the instances, both classic and new, where the Doctor serves as the teacher, the educator. You know, quickly coming to mind, you might think that just means, okay, you know, when he's got a companion and he's saying, let me show you something cool, hop in the TARDIS, I'm going to show you the planet of Zizaju. But it's more feedback encouraged.
Yes,
based on the volume we got of it this week, you know, we're holding you to these standards now, damn it.
Yep, it's like getting that, you know, that A- in high school, and now your parents expect it every time, and you just realize how horrible the mistake you made.
I only got a B+. I'm a failure.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you can send your feedback to us a number of ways. Obviously, feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Leave us the voicemails. We love the voicemails at 210-802-1477. It's 210-802-1477. You can also leave us comments on the show notes. You'll find us on Facebook. We're on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio. So any way that you can to get a hold of us, let us know, you know, which instances you see the Doctor the most as the teacher. Well, this has been episode 73 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, as Stephen Moffat himself put it, well, I'm permitted to say anything I like, I just don't.
He actually said that.
Yes.
What an asshole. and this is Kier saying, you know, tune in next week. We're going to say great stuff. You're going to love it. It's a cracker. It's going to be a cracker of an episode, really.
And this is Amy saying, thank you very much for having me on, and tune in next week because I won't be on.
Well, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's been fun. Thank you for having me.
We'll see you guys next week.
I'll see you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centered shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.